We moved into 1 Kings chapter 9 last week. And the chapter begins sometime after the halfway point of Solomon's 40-year reign. Now the temple is built, it's in operation, Solomon's extravagant palace is completed. King Shlomo's many building projects throughout his kingdom have elevated his personal fame and Israel's national status, and monarchs ruling far-flung kingdoms are curious, and they're envious of this amazingly wise king and the astounding wealth that this relatively small country has amassed almost overnight. Unexpectedly, the Lord God appears to Solomon in a dream vision, just as he had two decades earlier at the beginning of Shlomo's reign. God brings a dual-edged oracle to Solomon. First, it is to confirm that he has heard Solomon's prayers and his petitions at the temple dedication ceremony that was 13 years ago, and that he has been favorably looking upon them. But second, it's to issue a reminder that it is actually a not-so-veiled threat. Jehovah reminds Solomon that despite all the adulation and the notoriety that's being heaped upon him for his stupendous accomplishments, the future of Solomon's dynasty and the well-being of the nation of Israel shall always be subject to the Lord's discretion. The idea is that Solomon should not take it that because Israel and its king had become the envy of the world, that somehow this is indicative that all is right between Israel and God. The accumulation of wealth and of fame is not an earthly indication of righteousness or even necessarily harmony with God. Rather, it is that if Solomon expects for one of his sons to rule Israel after him, and if Israel is to continue under God's blessing, then there's four conditions that must be met. And obviously, Solomon meeting those conditions is currently in doubt, or the Lord wouldn't have offered his warning. What is so interesting is that we find confirmation yet again of the biblical principle that a nation's fate, from God's perspective, is all wrapped up in its leadership. The ideal king is a shepherd king. It's a leader who leads for the benefit of the people, not himself. It's a leader who sees himself as Joseph was in relation to the Pharaoh, kind of an under king, doing the will of the Almighty King. In God's economy, Israel's leader, as the ideal example for all leaders, was first and foremost to lead his people down godly paths using God's Torah as the map. Like a shepherd, it was not a matter of asking the sheep where they wanted to go and taking them there. Nor was it a matter of forcefully or deceptively taking the sheep someplace they ought not to go, because it's dangerous, maybe it's wicked, but maybe it would benefit the leader. Thus, the leader is responsible for the people as a congregation, and he or she also represents the spiritual condition of the people on a national basis before the Lord. This is an immutable God principle. It's not something that any nation can hold themselves up as being exempt. Thus, Israel's fate is squarely on Solomon's royal shoulders because the Lord's put it there. England's fate is on their prime minister's shoulders. The United States' fate is on our president's shoulders. And each represents the spiritual condition of the nation they govern before God. And so on, and so on for all the leaders of all the nations throughout the world in all times and in all eras. And thus the Lord lays out four conditions that Solomon must follow. Otherwise, the consequences are going to be what we find in 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 6 through 9. So open your Bibles there, please. 1 Kings chapter 9, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 380. We're going to read verses 6 through 9. But if you turn away from following me, you or your children, and you do not observe my mitzvot, my commandments, and regulations which I've set before you, and you go and you serve other gods, worshiping them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I've given them. This house, which I consecrated for my name, I will eject from my sight. And Israel will become an example to avoid, an object of scorn among all peoples. This house, now so exalted, everyone passing by will gasp in shock at the sight of it. And they'll ask, why has Adonai done this to this land and to this house? But the answer will be, it's because they abandoned Adonai their God, who brought their ancestors out of the land of Egypt, who took hold of other gods, worshiping and serving them. This is why Adonai brought all these calamities on them. Notice that there are two main consequences for not meeting these four conditions. God will abandon the temple, and God will eject Israel from the land. Now, several of the ancient sages have interpreted verse 6, where it says, take a look at it, but if you turn away from me, you or your children, as meaning King Solomon or the people of Israel. That is, your children mean the citizens of Israel. So the idea is that even if the king is righteous, if the people behave wickedly, then these curses of God will come upon the nation. Okay, that interpretation is terribly flawed. It's without any merit. And it only serves the rabbinical agenda, which is to prove that King Solomon, as was his father David, a 100% righteous man, despite what we might read about him in the scriptures. And thus, when Israel is divinely punished, it has nothing to do with any of the actions of David's descendants. Rather, it's the rebellion of the people. The words immediately preceding these are, you will never lack a man on the throne of Israel. And they are part of a reminder that Solomon is to obey God, or else that promise of a dynasty gets removed. Further, the same requirement of obedience then goes for each succeeding generation of Solomon's dynasty. So, the continuation of God's presence, as demonstrated by God's willingness to dwell in the temple, is conditional. And it's based on the worthiness of Israel's leadership. And if God abandons the temple, then it just becomes an empty shell that loses all of its value. Thus, verse 8 explains that what was once a magnificent monument to Jehovah that epitomized his glory being worked out through Israel will overnight turn into something that will shock those from other lands who knew it from prior times when God dwelled there and he was blessing it. Some people will look at the temple building in horror. Others will view it. They'll smirk. They'll enjoy its demise. But everyone, we're told, will ask, how did this happen? God says that because the current king of Israel disobeyed, because he elected to follow other gods, and he did not follow the four conditions set down, then the Lord views these actions as amounting to abandonment of him by the congregation as a whole. I mean, does it bother you a little bit that as followers or as citizens, you will be judged in some matters by the spiritual condition of your leader? It ought to. Consider then also that it cuts both ways. And this biblical principle is as foundational for a nation being cursed as it is for an individual being blessed. Because it is the righteousness of our leader, Yeshua HaMashiach, that makes us, his followers, eligible for God's blessing. As members of God's kingdom, with our king being God himself, then we will be judged follower by follower according to his deeds and perfection. Let's read a little bit more of chapter 9. I'm going to read from 10 through 14. Again, page 380 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. At the end of 20 years, during which time Shlomo, Solomon, had built the two buildings, the house of Adonai and the royal palace, King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of the Galil, the Galilee. Recall that Hiram, the king of Zoar, had supplied Shlomo with cedar and cypress logs and with all the gold Shlomo wanted. Hiram came over to Zoar to see the cities that Solomon had given him. He wasn't satisfied with them. He said, "What kind of cities are these which you've given me, my brother?" So they have been called the land of Kabul, good for nothing, till this day. Hiram had sent the king 4 tons of gold. Solomon has made a bad turn. He is now succumbing to his great wealth, his position, power, intellect. And King Hiram of Tyre, it seems, was a true partner in building the temple and Solomon's palace. Now in return, King Solomon seems to be giving away cities in Israel to Hiram in gratitude for his help. I mean, what a shameful thing to do. But apparently it was expedient. What we see here is something we always need to keep in mind. Be careful who you become indebted to, because someday you'll have to repay. Especially in the next chapter of 1 Kings, in the Queen of Sheba episode, we're going to get a glimpse of the otherworldly wealth that had become King Shlomo's and Israel's. But in case it hasn't occurred to you yet, none of it was coming from the land of Israel. It was all coming from foreign places. Israel has never had any valuable natural resources to harvest. They have no gold, no silver, no forests. They have no strange animals that are desired by other nations. Gold, silver, timber, precious gems, exotic creatures, they all had to be imported from abroad. They had to be provided by pagan Gentiles. King Solomon completely depended on non-God worshipers for expertise and materials, even to build the temple, the chief source of it being Hiram. Now, it was time to pay the piper. And of course, what would Solomon use to pay him? Except all that Israel had to offer. a piece of the promised land. It's interesting, however, to try to properly characterize the nature of what went on when Solomon offered these 20 Israelite cities and their surrounding territories up in the beautiful, fertile areas of the Northlands called the Galil, the Galilee. The way most translations have it is that Solomon offered these territories, and then Hiram came to view his new land. But he wasn't pleased with what he saw, so he rejected it, and he gave it back as an insult to Solomon. Thus, he gave the rejected 20-city region the negative epithet of Kabul. And it has been declared in the Bible commentaries that Kabul must mean worthless. However, there is another and much more likely interpretation. Most Jewish scholars have a problem with translating Kabul as meaning worthless. Rather, it more means binding or collateral. In other words, it's a term that has to do with debt and securing debt. Binding is meant in the sense of offering collateral as proof of a debt and as a binding surety for a debt. That makes a lot more sense in the context of this passage. Thus, what we have here is that Solomon didn't give these cities away to King Hiram per se. Instead, he offered them as a debt guarantee for the enormous national debt he had piled upon Israel, for the immense sums of gold and valuable and rare lumber and all the specialty skilled labor that he received from Hiram. See, Hiram was a friend and an ally of Israel, but he wasn't simple or naive. He, of course, held his own national interests above Israel's. So he would loan the modern equivalent of scores of millions of dollars to King Shlomo, but not without some concrete assurances that his nation would be repaid. Thus, these 20 cities of northern Israel were essentially collateral for a loan. Therefore, what happens if you default? The person who loans you the money keeps the collateral. And by the way, notice that King Solomon, who was a member of the southern Israelite tribe of Judah, didn't blink at offering Hiram some northern tribal territories as collateral for his projects. But of course, not one thing in Judah was put in jeopardy. Hiram went to see these 20 cities, found them as insufficient collateral, and he rejected them as such. When we think of the enormous amount of gold, here it is said to be 4 tons. That's the gold that Hiram loaned to Solomon, plus the vast quantities of materials and labor. Hiram must have had high expectations for the value of this region up in the Galilee. Obviously, the region failed to meet his expectations. Thus, the region became known as what it was, Kabul, collateral. That certainly would have been a degrading name as far as its residents were concerned. Hiram had already given Solomon the bulk of the labor and material, so it was too late to break the deal, which he probably wouldn't have done anyway. But in the end, Solomon really can't be regarded as any less guilty for putting at risk part of God's kingdom as surety for a loan from a pagan than for simply exchanging the land for payment of the loan, because if Solomon had defaulted on it, the result would have been the same. And yet, there is a caveat for all this that might help to explain Solomon's attitude about these cities and not being very concerned about what became of them. In 2 Chronicles 8:1, we read this. At the end of 20 years, during which time Solomon had built the house of Adonai in his own palace, Solomon built up the cities which Huram had given to Shlomo and had the people of Israel living there. In this passage, Hiram is called Huram. This is just a typical issue in ancient Hebrew of trying to determine vowel sounds, by the way. And apparently the idea is that these 20 cities were indeed in Israelite territory, but they were being occupied by non-Israelites, Canaanites probably, on a peaceful basis, and they had given their allegiance to Solomon. And we read that on a number of occasions, Solomon used the resources of non-Hebrews living in Israel for his own profit, because the Hebrew majority wouldn't have protested that approach. So Solomon offered the collateral of 20 cities that were populated with non-Israelites. This displeased Hiram, because of course, as a king, he fully understood that what Solomon offered as a loan guarantee wasn't all that valuable to Solomon, as it would have been if tribal Israelites had possessed these cities. However, later on, Solomon put government funds into building up these cities, and when he did, naturally, he moved Israelites into these formerly Canaanite-populated cities. Politicians are always politicians. Now, this was probably a very popular move, and probably one designed to placate the northern Israelite tribes, who would have felt rather insulted for Solomon offering parts of their territory to Hiram. So, as we all know, politicians have always known how to spend other people's money for their own benefit. Let's move on and read a little bit more of 1 Kings chapter 9. Let's read verses 15 through 23. Following the account of the forced labor levied by King Shlomo for building the house of Adonai, his own palace, the Milo, the wall of Yerushalayim, and the cities of Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up. He had taken Gezer. He'd burned it to the ground and killed the Canaanites living in the city. Then he'd given it as a dowry for his daughter, Shlomo's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer. He also built Lower Beit Horon, Baalat, and Tadmor in the desert, in the land, as well as all the cities that Shlomo had for storing supplies, the cities of his chariots, the cities for his horsemen, and the other buildings Solomon wanted to build for himself in Jerusalem, in the Lebanon, and throughout the land he ruled. All the people still left from the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not part of the people of Israel, that is, their descendants remaining after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were not able to destroy completely, from them Solomon levied his forced laborers, as it is to this day. But Solomon did not raise any of his forced labor from the people of Israel. Rather, they were the soldiers, his servants, administrators, commanders, the officials in charge of his chariots and horsemen. There were 550 chief officers over Shlomo's work in charge of the workers. Where our modern politicians have nothing on Solomon. Here we see that he was the tax and spend king of Israel. But thankfully, in our time, the tax is always money. What we see in these passages is that the levy that Solomon put upon his people was primarily forced labor. We get a list of the major projects that this conscripted labor force was used for. And besides the temple and Solomon's personal palace, is listed something called the Milo, and then the walls of Jerusalem, and then the cities of Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Which, by the way, as it turns out, if you're going to Israel with me, you're going to visit every one of these cities. And we're going to begin to run across these places and names regularly from here forward. And some play a significant role in end times matters. So let's take a few minutes to familiarize ourselves with them. Now, the Milo literally means an earthen rampart. It's a fortified wall structure used as a defensive position on the Kidron Valley side of the city of David. Its design is as a retaining wall that's been backfilled with soil and rubble. The Milo that we read about here has been rediscovered and confirmed, and you can visit it when you go with me to Israel. It was originally built by the Jebusites, later on fortified by David, and now built and strengthened further by King Solomon. The wall of Jerusalem, is referring to the defensive walls that went beyond those of the city of David. Solomon had been extending the city on up the hill towards the Temple Mount. There was this undeveloped space in between the city of David and the Temple Mount that was called the Ophel. And this was where Jerusalem was actually first expanded. This wall of Jerusalem, mentioned here, is bound to be a wall designed to join the city of David to the Temple Mount. So then it completely encloses the area called the Ophel. Now, Hazor and Megiddo are in the Galilee region, and both are strategic military outposts along the invaluable Via Maris trade route. Hazor served as a fortress. It was designed to guard the northern flank of Israel from the area of Syria. Now, likely, this was one of Solomon's most important fortifications. Megiddo is better known today in Christian circles as Har Megiddo or Armageddon. Har means hill or mountain, thus the name, the hill of Megiddo, Har Megiddo. This is the place of the end times prophetic war to end all wars. In ancient times, it guarded the pass into the Jezreel Valley that over the centuries was the major north-south and east-west trade crossroads. And it was also a battlefield and an amazingly fertile agricultural region since time immemorial. This may have been Solomon's most famous and extensive chariot city outside of Jerusalem. And one can see the excavated remains of his stables and fortifications to this day. Now, Gezer and Beit Horon were in the center of Israel, more or less at the southern border of Ephraim's tribal territory. We get an interesting aside in verse 16 explaining how King Shlomo had acquired this place, Gezer. I want to pause for just a moment to note that by these passages explaining how Gezer became an Israelite city, and a few verses earlier how the 20 cities used as collateral for a debt owed to King Hiram in time became Hebrew cities, we see that still into Solomon's day, Israel had many pockets of cities and towns within their promised land that were still Canaanite, still occupied by some group of foreigners or another. It would be as though in modern America, there would be substantial towns and cities that were thoroughly, say, Native American and not assimilated into the European-based American culture. So it's not a matter of an enemy occupying some cities within an otherwise sovereign nation. Rather, these were cities primarily occupied by other ethnic groups and generally on peaceful terms with Israel. Now, Gezer was a Canaanite city that had been captured some years earlier by Solomon's father-in-law, Pharaoh Siamun of Egypt. He had destroyed that city by fire. But then he gave the remains of the city to his daughter as a wedding present for her marriage to King Solomon. The bottom line here is that the marriage of Pharaoh's daughter to Solomon, plus the giving of the defeated but destroyed Canaanite city of Gezer to Solomon, created a strong and friendly political alliance between Israel and Egypt. Gezer was in a strategically valuable location, and as soon as he possibly could, Solomon moved Hebrews into that city and used government funds to rebuild it. It was strategic because it controlled that particular section of the Via Maris trade route, and it was 700 feet above sea level, making it a marvelous lookout point where you could see miles in every direction. Now, interestingly, again to demonstrate the geopolitical reality of the Israelites' time in the Promised Land, we read in Joshua 10 that centuries earlier, Joshua actually captured Gezer, killed the king, and then the Philistines somehow gained control of it. It was even assigned the important status, interestingly, as a Levitical city in Joshua 21. Apparently, the Philistines eventually lost control to some Canaanites. The Canaanites lost control to Egypt. Now, Egypt gave control to Solomon as a political gift of friendship. So, this acquisition of land and territory was uneven, and often the same piece of land changed hands regularly for any number of reasons. Well, Egypt's interest in Gezer was economic. It had to do with the Via Maris trade route. Gezer became another of Solomon's chariot cities, and each of these chariot cities was also where Israel's tax collectors had offices to extract a levy from all the trade caravans that passed through it. Toll gates, essentially. We also find a fleeting mention of Solomon building buildings in Lebanon. Yes, the Lebanon we know today. So we can see just how far north his influence had extended. But starting in verse 20, we get a listing of the various ethnic groups that still lived in Israel, living in Israelite tribal territories, but in peace with Israel and under Solomon's rule. And it was from these various groups that Solomon conscripted the labor for his many projects. Verse 22 makes it clear that Solomon did not use Hebrews as forced laborers. That, of course, was a political consideration. Instead, in a kind of role reversal for how it was for Israel and Egypt, the Israelites were the foremen and taskmasters over a foreign labor pool. And national Israelites also formed the loyal government administrators and military commanders and all these officials that work for Solomon. I want to also be clear that while this was forced labor, the laborers were not slaves. It was no different than the taxes we all pay to our government, which is forced, so to speak. We don't pay taxes by choice, but we're not slaves, even though the law compels us to give, or maybe we'll wind up being slaves in jail if we don't. It was in that way in Israel under Solomon, except that in this instance, the taxes amounted to labor, not to money. Let's finish off chapter 9, beginning at verse 24. Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon had built for her, and after that he built the Millo. Three times a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar which he had built for Adonai, offering incense with them on the altar before Adonai, so he finished the house. King Solomon built a fleet of ships in Etzion Geber by Eilat on the shore of the Sea of Suf in the land of Edom. Hiram sent some of his own servants, experienced sailors who understood the sea, to serve with Shlomo's servants. They went to Ophir, took from their gold 14 tons of it, which they brought back to King Solomon. Hebrew tradition better explains why this verse about Solomon's Egyptian wife and her move from the city of David to the palace was included. It was that when Solomon married her, he gave her a place to live in the city of David. And as soon as he could, he built a palace outside of the city of David and moved her into it. David had used the area of the Milo as a place for the many pilgrims who visited Jerusalem, for them to meet and to congregate. It was intentionally arranged as like a big open public area. But Solomon confiscated it, and he built private quarters upon it for his wife's servants, thus eliminating it for use by just common pilgrims. So we get the words that only after Pharaoh's daughter was moved into her new quarters did the Milo refurbishment occur that entirely changed its character from a public meeting place to private quarters for the king's servants. Verse 25 seems straightforward enough until we consider what's being implied. First, the mention of Solomon officiating over sacrifices three times per year is referring to the three Torah-ordained Chag, or pilgrimage biblical feasts, of Matzah, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Now, what makes this troubling is that we have Solomon offering the sacrifices at the altar. Think about that. Solomon offering the sacrifices at the altar. And that was, by Torah law, a task only for the priests to perform. This is just one of the many indulgences that King Solomon took upon himself. It was seriously wrong, it was sinful, and it shows Solomon's rapid descent into his own self-importance and a sense that he was authorized to manipulate or to change God's laws at his whim. Well, to end this chapter, we get a most interesting few words about Solomon building a fleet of ships. This took place on the finger of the Red Sea, called the Gulf of Aqaba. The building of ships and their home port was near the city of Eilat. And if you're going with me to Israel, you're going to go to Eilat. I hope I'm making you jealous, those of you who aren't going, because I want you to go someday. Ancient Eilat is on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba and what is actually the modern-day Jordan. Modern Eilat is on the western side of the Gulf, but it's a port city. As Israel was certainly not a nation of seafarers, Solomon was able to get Hiram to send him some of his experienced sailors and shipbuilders to supervise and to teach. This fleet sailed the Red Sea, stopping at Arabian and at particularly northern African ports of call, probably ventured as far as into the Indian Ocean. The mention of Ophir as a place where gold was obtained in substantial quantities has always intrigued Bible scholars, and there is no agreement as to its location. However, any idea that it was in the Mediterranean, as is often surmised, is illogical. It's unrealistic, and certainly Solomon's fleet did not sail down the eastern course of Africa, around the Horn of Africa, around South Africa, and then back up to Africa's west coast to enter the Mediterranean through the Straits of Gibraltar. That's not what happened. Well, let's move on to chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 10. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 381. Follow along, please. 1 Kings chapter 10 is a famous story you've heard about since we were kids. The Queen of Sheba. When the Queen of Sheba heard what was being said about Solomon because of the name of Adonai, she came to test him with difficult questions. She arrived in Jerusalem accompanied by a very great retinue, including camels bearing spices and gold in great abundance and precious stones. And when she appeared before Shlomo, she spoke with him about everything on her heart. Shlomo answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And after the Queen of Sheba had seen all of Solomon's wisdom, the palace he had built, the food at his table, the manner of seating his officials, the manner in which his staff served him, how they were dressed, his personal servants, and his burnt offering which he offered in the house of Adonai, it left her breathless. And she said to the king, "What I heard in my own country about your deeds and your wisdom is true, but I couldn't believe the report until I came and saw it for myself. Actually, they didn't even tell me the half of it. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the reports I heard. Oh, how happy your people must be. How happy these servants of yours who are always here attending you, and they get to hear your wisdom. Blessed be Adonai, your God, who took pleasure in you to put you on the throne of Israel. Because of Adonai's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to administer judgment and justice fairly." Then she gave the king 4 tons of gold, a huge amount of spices and precious stones. Never again did there arrive such an abundance of spices as those the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Hiram's fleet, which he had brought gold from Ophir, now brought in from Ophir a large quantity of sandalwood and precious stones. The king used the sandalwood to make columns for the house of Adonai and for the royal palace, and also lyres and lutes for the singers. No sandalwood like it has come or been seen to this day. King Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba everything she wanted, whatever she asked, in addition to the presents he gave her on his own initiative. And after this, she returned, and she went back to her own country, she and her servants. The weight of the gold that Solomon received annually came to 22 tons of gold, besides that which came from sales taxes, customs duties, and assessments collected by all the kings of the mixed peoples and by the district governors. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 15 pounds of gold went into one shield. He made 300 more shields of hammered gold, with 3¾ pounds going into one shield. The king put these in the house of the Lebanon forest. The king also made a large throne of ivory, and he overlaid it with the finest gold. The throne had 6 steps, a back with a rounded top, arms on either side of the seat, 2 lions standing beside the arms, and 12 more lions standing on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like it had been made in any kingdom. All King Shlomo's drinking vessels were made of gold. All the utensils in the house of the Lebanon forest were of pure gold. None was of silver, for in Shlomo's time it was regarded as having little value. The king had a fleet of large Tarshish ships, along with Hiram's fleet, and once every 3 years the Tarshish fleet came in, bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings on earth in both wealth and wisdom. All the earth sought to have an audience with Shlomo in order to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each one brought his present, articles of silver, articles of gold, clothing, armor, spices, horses, and mules, and this continued year after year. Shlomo amassed chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen. He assigned them to the chariot cities and to the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver in Jerusalem as common as stones. He made cedars as abundant as sycamore fig trees are in the Shephelah. Solomon's horses had been brought from Egypt and from Keba. And with the king's agents having brought them from the dealers in Keba at the going price. A chariot from Egypt cost 15 pounds of silver shekels, and a horse 3¾ pounds of shekels. All the kings of the Hittim and the kings of Aram purchased them at these prices through Solomon's agents. Well, this chapter begins with the story of the famous Queen of Sheba. And it's put here to show that God fulfilled his promise to Solomon to gift him with great wisdom and unprecedented wealth. Now, we're not going to get very much farther today than the first verse. And so, because there's more here than meets the eye, I first want to talk about who the Queen of Sheba might have actually been. It's nearly certain that due to a copyist error, the spelling of Sheba, which is actually pronounced Sheba, ought to have been a seen and not a sheen. That is, we should give the first letter of her name the sound of an S, not of an SH. Thus, she was the queen of Saba, not the queen of Sheba. The city of Saba was the ancient capital of the Arabian culture of the Sabaeans. They were traders in gold, incense, and precious stones. These descendants of Ishmael were located along the Arabian coast of the Red Sea, and they were known to traditionally have queens, not kings. They were moon god worshipers. And as one might well expect, there is a very close tie between Islam and the Sabaeans. In fact, the account of the queen of the Sabaeans, the queen of Saba, we say the queen of Sheba, and her visit with Solomon is actually told in the Muslim Quran in Surah 27. Our English translations hide a really interesting wordplay in this first verse, where the English says that the Queen of Sheba heard what was being said about Shlomo because of the name of Jehovah God. The Hebrew says this: the Queen of Sheba shema what was being shama of Shlomo because of the Shem of Yehovah. Not only do we have a memorable litany of the Hebrew letter Sheen, but also a word play on the Hebrew word Shema. And what is being said is that the Queen of Sheba, Shema, she heard and she acted on the Shema, the report or description about Solomon because of the Shem, the reputation or the name of his God, Yehovah. That's what's being said here. And the idea is that the God of Israel, Yehovah, was getting credit as Solomon's God for all the amazing wealth and wisdom of Solomon and his nation of Israel. This is why it's good to know a little Hebrew. We're also told that she came to test him with hard questions. In Hebrew, she came to Nasa Shlomo with Kedot. Nasa means to test or to prove. Kedot means riddles. So quite literally, the Queen of Saba came all the way to meet Solomon and to test to see if his wisdom was as stupefying as she had heard. And she was going to do it by giving him riddles to solve. I think that's all for this week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.